GoDaddy.com. Use the code PODNAME139 for $7.49.com domain names, normally $9.95. GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1148, August 31st, 2009.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from a service plaza along the Indiana Turnpike. Just under 90 miles away from where I deliver to Manteno, Illinois. I'll be doing that tomorrow. In the last podcast, for some reason, I was thinking that today was Saturday, but actually today is Sunday, and so tomorrow is Monday. So I'll be delivering there probably sometime, you know, realistically probably sometime to Monday afternoon, maybe. It just kind of depends on what time I get up, but it'll probably be sometime in the afternoon when I deliver the load there to Manteno, Illinois, and it should be a drop and hook. I was quite surprised as I came across Pennsylvania. The temperature was in the 60s, and I was really surprised. I guess it must be maybe a lake effect type of thing that's going on, but here where I'm at in Indiana, it's, you know, map wise it doesn't look like it's that far from Lake Michigan. And when I stopped several hours ago here, actually, at this service plaza along the Indiana Turnpike, the temperature was 54 degrees. This is August 31st. It was 54 degrees. It's 54 degrees, and it may even be cooler than that now. I've actually got my heater set so that the heater will, the optimized idle will periodically start up, and the heater will actually come on and warm it up in here, if you can believe that. And it's August the 31st. It's just amazing. And then, you know, and I can imagine that, it's maybe even cooler, and, you know, someplace like Chicago may even be cooler than it is right here, if you can imagine that. But that's pretty amazing that it's this cool here. I haven't really, you know, I don't know. I haven't watched, looked at any weather forecasts or, so I don't know. It's possible that there may be even some colder weather in other parts of the country. Got a number of news stories here that kind of look a little bit interesting. I guess there's a big fire going on in Southern California. I guess it's that the fire time of year, and they always have these problems. And apparently, you know, according to the story that I have here, there's a it's in the San Bernardino Mountains. It's the mountains that are north, you know, that are kind of on the northern, that sort of, that form the northern edge of the Los Angeles area, you know, because Los Angeles, you know, and the suburbs just kind of butt up against those mountains, and, you know, that's where this big fire is. And according to this article, I'll just read the headline: Strike Force Formed to Save Communication Towers. Mount Wilson. I guess there's an observatory there, too, at Mount Wilson, if I'm thinking correctly. Firefighters will attempt to keep a strike force of fire engines on Mount Wilson, where critical communication facilities are in jeopardy of being overrun, a fire official said. Our original plan was to pull all firefighters off of it for now, said Mark Savage of the Los Angeles County Fire Department. Right now, a strike team of engines is seeing if they can find a safe place to shelter up there. We're concerned that it will be overrun, and we think it will burn, but we're not sure if the communication facilities will be overrun. By late afternoon, a huge plume of smoke rose from the western side of the peak, and the fire was creating winds, pushing it to the east up the peak. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when, Savage said earlier. Dozens of TV technicians are normally stationed at Mount Wilson to keep 22 Los Angeles TV stations operating, along with about 25 FM radio stations and vital police and fire radio dispatch equipment functioning. Everybody is off the mountain. There was one last caretaker, but they took him off, said Fire Info Officer Larry Marinas. Fire officials were huddling at the command post in Lakeview Terrace, and an update on the blaze was expected around 7:30 p.m. Most electronic operations on the mountain can be run by remote control, but power and communication lines are vulnerable. Most satellite and cable companies have direct feeds from major TV stations to bypass a failure on Mount Wilson, but over-the-air TV and FM signals could be lost, along with hundreds of public safety radio repeaters that amplify signals from Tijuana to Santa Barbara. So that is just an ongoing problem for the Los Angeles area, Southern California area, every year. It seems like it's just, you know, it's a problem of the desert. Commercial real estate lurks as next potential mortgage crisis. And this is from online.wsj.com, so it's a Wall Street Journal. Federal Reserve and Treasury officials are scrambling to prevent the commercial real estate sector from delivering a roundhouse punch to the U.S. economy just as it struggles to get up off the mat. The efforts could be undermined by the surge in foreclosures of commercial property carrying mortgages that were packaged and sold by Wall Street as bonds. Similar mortgage-backed securities created out-of-home loans played a big role in undoing that sector and triggering the global economic recession. Now, the $700 billion of commercial mortgage-backed securities outstanding are being tested for the first time by a massive downturn, and the outcome so far hasn't been pretty. So this was, you know, there's been people that have been predicting this, you know, that the commercial thing would downturn next, that Gerald Celente, months and months ago, was predicting this. You can go back and watch his predictions, listen to his predictions, but he clearly predicted that this was going to be the next thing, because if people have no jobs and no money, then you know, the commercial sector is the next thing to fall, and so we're probably going to see more and more, and I'm already seeing it, more and more commercial real estate that's vacant. I see a lot of vacant, like strip malls, and you know, in various places. So that's kind of predictable, and it's probably going to continue to get worse. And there's this article from the Telegraph.co.uk, and I don't know if I mentioned this one or not. Dual screen laptop on sale by Christmas, and they've got a picture of this thing. And it's really rather kind of massive looking. It's a pretty good sized laptop, and from what it's describing, it's got two equally sized 15.4 inch screens. And I guess they're normally, if the thing is closed, they're kind of stacked on top of each other, one in front of the other. But when you open it up and you want to use it, you just slide each one of these things. You slide the one on top to the right and the one that's underneath it to the left. And then you've got two 15.4 screens, which gives you two displays, basically. And so you can kind of move things around on one. I guess it would be, I don't know what you'd say, it would be two 15.4-inch widescreens side by side. And so that would give you, I don't know how many square inches of real estate, but that would be a serious little workstation. But they're expecting it to be priced around $3,000. And it's going to be pretty, it's not going to be light either, and it's obviously not going to have very good battery life. But, on the other hand, that would be something you could carry around, and most people that are carrying around a massively powerful big laptop like that are probably going to be plugging it in. They may carry it into a, motel room or into a business with them where they can set the thing up, and but that's kind of a massive looking machine. I don't know if I need anything quite that large, because you'd really need a desk to put it on. But that's pretty interesting that someone has actually came up with this. I'm surprised that someone hasn't come up with this before. That's pretty interesting. By the way, I'm doing this a little bit differently this evening. I'm using, right now, what I ended up doing after I stopped, I plugged my, I've got the 13-inch MacBook, and I've got the 17-inch MacBook Pro, and, so I went ahead and pulled the 13-inch MacBook out, because it's been a while since I had it out of the travel case that I have, and so I wanted to plug it in and charge it, and so it was, it's been charging for probably about the last hour and a half, and so I, I'm recording this actually with the Zoom H2, but I've got that netbook. I'm using that netbook as the, I have that in front of me for the, so I can get online, But I'm using Google Chrome on that netbook, and I've got a ton of tabs open. And I have to say that even on that netbook, now that netbook has a, it's got 2 gigabytes of RAM and 1.6 gigahertz Atom processor, and Google Chrome so far, even with all the, there's probably at least 15 tabs open, and Google Chrome is performing flawlessly. So once Google Chrome becomes available for OS 10, I'm going to install it, and that may end up being my browser of choice, because quite frankly, Firefox, it seems, if I open that many tabs up in Firefox, it gets to where it's sluggish, and it's it's not using the memory very well, very efficiently. I think Firefox has kind of suffered from software bloat, and Google, I guess, kind of taking the cue from the success of their own, keeping their website, their search website simple, has kept this browser very simple, very, very light memory footprint, and the thing just, I really like it. And it is, Google Chrome is available, or it is under development, rather, for OS 10, and as soon as it becomes available, I'm gonna download it, of course, and begin to use it. Because I would expect that they would do just like they have with Windows and keep it as light as they possibly can. And it really does pay off. Now it's not a perfect browser. It does, not everything will work in it, but it pretty much, they keep working on it, and it really does, I really like it. I really think that it's a big deal. I really like it. Anyway, continuing on, Pakistan reality TV contest, and the guy's name is Saeed Khan, drowns performing challenge. A contestant on Pakistani reality TV show drowned while performing a challenge for the program. Spokeswoman for the show's sponsor said on Sunday. Saad Khan, 32, was swimming across a lake while wearing 15 pounds backpack when he called out for help and then disappeared underwater, according to Farashte Aslam, the information officer for Unilever Pakistan, the as-yet-unnamed show's sponsor. Horrified co-contestants and crew rushed to save him, but could not find him in the murky waters of the lake in the Thai capital, of Bangkok, where the show was being filmed. Divers later recovered the body of Mr. Khan, said Ms. Aslam. The death came during filming of the show's 10th episode on August 19, but it was not publicized until Mr. Khan's body was returned home to the southern Pakistani city of Karachi. The police were investigating to determine whether the death was an accident or caused by negligence. Bangkok's Kham Chad Luik newspaper reported Unilever Pakistan accepts no liability for Khan's death, Ms. Aslam said. But she added that the company is in a discussion to provide Mr. Khan's wife and four children out of rightness, to provide for Mr. Khan's wife and four children out of rightness, quote unquote. A close friend of Mr. Khan, Barber Jamani, said by telephone that the family was not ready to talk to the media and he declined further comment. Mr. Khan had already been eliminated in the show's previous rounds, but had returned for a special challenge to earn a spot in the finals. Plans to air the reality show, intended as a promotional tie to Unilever's Clear Shampoo, were on hold. Ms. Aslam said that Unilever Pakistan, a division of the multinational soap and cosmetics maker, was not involved in the production of the show, which was handled by a director and crew from the Indian entertainment capital of Mumbai. Reality television shows often subject contenders to harsh physical challenges. In May, a contestant on the Bulgarian version of The Survivor died of a heart attack while filming on an island in the Philippines' Nancho something or other. 53 collapsed after finishing an unspecified activity for the contest, Philippine police said. So Unilever should, if they're smart, they'll just never air that. That should just be dropped, and maybe they pay people off and forget about it. Going back to the banks, Meltdown 101, why bank struggles have worsened. As the economy shows signs of life, why do bank struggles continue to worsen? Washington, despite signs of improving economy, the nation's banks are still struggling. In fact, the pace of bank failures has accelerated. What would it take to turn the banking sector around? And what can people do to protect their savings in the meantime? Here are some questions and answers about the wave of U.S. bank failures, as the latest quarterly snapshot of the industry painted a grim picture. How bad is this wave of failures? A cascade of collapses began last year As the financial crisis struck, 84 banks have fallen so far this year as tumbling home prices and spiking unemployment pushed loan defaults upwards. That's the largest number in a year since the early 1930s. At the apex of the savings and loan crisis, it compares with 25 bank failures last year and three in 2007. The failures have slapped billions from the federal deposit, or sapped rather, billions of from the Federal Deposit Insurance Fund, which guarantees account holders money when banks go under. The fund stood at $10.4 billion in the second quarter, at its lowest point since 1992. The biggest failure this year, Colonial Bank, a heavy regional lender in real estate development based in Montgomery, Alabama, which became the sixth largest bank failure in U.S. history on August 14th. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation seized Colonial and sold its $20 billion in deposits, 346 branches in five states, and about $22 billion of its assets to BB&T Corporation. Some analysts believe another 100 to 300 banks could fail before the crisis runs its course, largely because of surrounding loans, or souring loans rather, for the commercial real estate for commercial real estate. The number of institutions on the FDIC's internal problem list, those rated by examiners as having very low capital cushions against risk and other deficiencies, jumped to 416 at the end of June from 305 in the first quarter, the agency reported Thursday. What's behind this? Answer: banks around the country have run into trouble on their loans for construction and development, the fastest growing category of troubled loans for U.S. banks, especially in overbuilt areas. Many companies have shut down in the recession, vacating shopping malls and office buildings financed by the loans. Lots of banks have heavy concentrations of these loans in their lending portfolios, and some small banks are considered by regulators to be particularly vulnerable. Delinquent loan payments and defaults by commercial and residential developers have surged to the highest levels since early 1990s during the S&L crisis. At the same time, some recent failures have been smaller banks brought down by garden variety loans that have soured during the recession. Regulators say they are concerned about growing delinquencies on prime conventional home loans. So even though the economy is starting to recover, banks are still struggling? Answer: the condition of the banking industry is what economists call a lagging indicator. It falls behind the state of the economy because the problems take longer to percolate through banks, as opposed to other signposts such as consumer spending, gross domestic product, or permits for building construction. That means the pain will continue to weigh on the banking sector while the economy rebounds. FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair offered a reminder on Thursday. Banking industry performance is, as always, a lagging indicator. What will it take to turn the banking industry around? Answer: not much other than time, experts say. The only thing you could do is to ignore the losses that are already there, said Karen Shaw Petro, managing partner of Federal Finance Analytics in Washington. That would be a terrible mistake, she said, noting that the regulator's blind eye in the 1980s prolonged the S&L crisis. The best thing for the banking industry is to just take it on the chin and move on, she said. Question: what about me? What can I do to protect my money in the bank? Answer: accounts are insured by the FDIC, up to $250,000 per depositor per bank. Joint accounts are insured up to that amount for each co-owner of the account. Individual retirement accounts, or IRAs, held in banks are also insured. If you have multiple individual accounts at one bank, it's important to structure them carefully so they don't exceed the limits. The FDIC has a calculator on its website called the Electronic Deposit Insurance Estimator, or EDIE, that can help determine how much money in a deposit accounts, if any, exceeds the insurance limits. You can find it here, and then they've got a tiny URL that I'm not going to read. For any money in a failed bank's deposit accounts that exceed the insured's limits, you become essentially a creditor of the bank. You would eventually recover some of your money, but the amount can range from 40 cents on the dollar up to the full amount. Recovery of the money could take months. So, you know, when it comes to banks, you know, you still have to, you know, beware. Clinton and Gore reunite in Tennessee, Nashville. Two old friends, fresh from a day of mourning in rainy Boston, came south Saturday night to pledge to a room full of roaring Tennessee Democrats that Ted Kennedy's dream, indeed, will never die. Al Gore and Bill Clinton, ghosts of Democratic victories past, who are increasingly showing up to buck up the faithful as President Obama goes through his first real trials in office, were the star guests at the Tennessee Democrat Party's annual Jackson Day dinner. As you would expect from two very skilled old pros, they were careful not to inject a note of abject partisanship into a day when much of the nation watched the services and burial for the legendary Massachusetts senator, a man Gore called by far the most effective member of the United States Senate that I've ever served with. And both men, as was Obama in his eulogy early in the day, seemed deliberately careful to underline the bipartisan mourners who helped take Kennedy to his final rest Saturday. There were as many Republicans as Democrats in that church today, Gore said. But Clinton and Gore also offered a skillfully threaded approach that might allow Team Obama to channel the emotion and determination many party activists feel at Kennedy's loss without spilling over into the kind of raw partisan sentiment that Republicans have warned will trigger a major pushback as an inappropriate attempt to make political hay out of Kennedy's death. Clinton, who made a bit of political history by actually arriving early for this event, gave a typically rambling, discursive lecture among other things, the history of American politics since 1968 and the history of health care reform from 1994 on, accompanied by a corrective lesson explaining how the failure of his health care initiative really didn't cost Democrats control of Congress in 1994. 25 minutes into the speech, the customary warning sign for veteran Clinton watchers appeared. I don't want to bore you with all the details, but the message on a day when Kennedy was remembered as being devoted to the American society was that Democrats need to fight. On that, the now silver-haired man from Hope was resoundingly clear. You have to back these congressmen and let them know you're not going to let them be steamrolled by a bunch of people who have been frightened, Clinton said, in reference to the town hall tumult of the last few weeks. Don't let anybody tell you that President Obama wants to ration health care. We are rationing health care in America. I am not a very good politician anymore. I just say what I think, Clinton said. But I have been waiting for this for 40 years to recreate the American dream. Gore, in a much shorter set of remarks, was loose-limbed and noticeably thinner than in recent years, and he seemed to elicit the night's most emotional moment, playing off of the focus of the Kennedy funeral on the Gospel of Matthew, parable of Jesus taking care of the least of us. Gore thundered that in the country that has a moral duty to pass health care reform this year. So, vomit. So they got a picture here. And Clinton, I don't know, this, I guess it's a real picture. It has to be. Well, it doesn't have to be, but it looks real. They've got a picture of Clinton. You know, Clinton's on the left, Gore's on the right. You know, you can see, you know, they got, you know, Clinton's face is kind of angled towards the camera, but it's kind of a, you know, the side from a side shot from the right side. And then you can see kind of the back left of Gore's head, and their faces are like 2 inches apart. You know, it's like, you know, that they could burst out into a kiss at any moment. Maybe I can put that in the show notes. Sickening. Let's see what else there is. Oh, this is interesting. opposition wins landslide in Japan election. Tokyo, Japan's ruling conservative party, suffered a crushing defeat in election Sunday as voters overwhelmingly cast their ballots in favor of a left-of-center opposition camp that has promised to rebuild the economy and breathe new life into the country after 54 years of virtual one-party rule, media projections said. The opposition Democrat Party of Japan was set to win 300 to 480 seats in the lower house of parliament, ousting the Liberal Democrats, who have governed Japan for all but 11 months since of 1955, according to projections by all major Japanese TV networks. Now, this doesn't make any sense, because in the first paragraph they said Japan's ruling conservative party. And then now they're saying the opposition Democrat Party of Japan was set to win 300 of 480 seats in the lower house of parliament, ousting the Liberal Democrats, and that's in capitals. So how could they, if they're conservative party, how are they Liberal Democrats? So that's confusing. So I'm not even going to bother reading the rest of that, because whoever wrote that, Eric Talmadge, it doesn't make any sense. It's absurd. So both of the parties in Japan are, they're called Democrat. They're both Democrats. Some of them are Democrats and the other one are Liberal Democrats. That's kind of funny. Venezuela accuses protesters of attempting rebellion. Venezuela's top prosecutor said Saturday that recent street protests were legally tantamount to quote-unquote rebellion against President Hugo Chavez's government, and that demonstrators will now be charged. The dramatic move by Attorney General Luisa Ortega capped a week of huge street protests, mostly directed against a new education law that critics say is politically charged. People who disturb order and the peace, to create instability of institutions, to destabilize the government or attack the democratic system, are going to charge and try them, Ortega said in a statement referring to the government of leftist populist Chavez. William Ojeda, of the opposition, a New Time party, argued that the very right to protest is being turned into a crime. The justice system is now being used as a tool of political and ideological persecution, Ojeda added. Ortega claimed opposition groups were looking for any reason to march, to create chaos, whatever they can. What they want is to destabilize, even by encouraging people to disobey the law. Last Saturday, thousands of marchers protested against the education law, and police used tear gas to break up the crowds and keep them from marching on the National Assembly. These precise actions are, in effect, criminal civil rebellion, Ortega stressed, warning in her statement that the crime carries sentences of between 12 and 24 years. I want those people who have risen up against the government with a hostile attitude against a legally formed government to know what the consequences are, Ortega warned. Earlier this week, 11 workers with the Caracas mayor's office, led by opposition mayor Antonio Ledezma, were jailed for resisting authority. On Thursday, former Cuban leader Fidel Castro accused the United States of seeking to quote-unquote eliminate Venezuela's leftist government and amass power in South America through a controversial deal allowing it to access military bases in Colombia. Castro said the real U.S. objective in Colombia was to eliminate the revolutionary process begun by Chavez, a key Cuban ally, and to gain control of the oil and other natural resources in Venezuela. So that's where we're headed in the U.S. You know, you protest, and all of a sudden it's a rebellion, and then they're going to use the government to arrest you and throw you in jail. 57% would like to replace the entire Congress. If they could vote to keep or replace the entire Congress, just 25% of voters nationwide would keep the current batch of legislators. A new Rasmussen Reports National Telephone Survey finds that 57% would vote to replace the entire Congress and start all over again. 18% are not sure of how they would vote. Overall, these numbers are little changed since last October, when Congress was passing the unpopular $700 billion bailout plan in the heat of the presidential campaign and a seeming financial industry meltdown. 59% wanted to throw them all out. At that time, just 17% wanted to keep them. There has been a bit of partisan shift since last fall, with Democrats controlling both chambers of Congress. It's not surprising to find that the number of Democrats who would vote to keep the entire Congress has grown from 25% last fall to 43% today. In fact, a modest plurality of Democrats would now vote to keep the legislators. Last fall, a plurality of Democrats were ready to throw them all out. While Democrats have become more supportive of the legislators, voters not affiliated with either major party have moved in the opposite direction. Today, 70% of those not affiliated with either major party would vote to replace all of the elected politicians in the House and the Senate. That's up from 62% last year. Republicans, not surprisingly, overwhelmingly supported replacing everyone in Congress. Their views have not changed. But Republican voters are disenchanted with their team as much as the Congress itself. 69% of GOP voters say Republicans in Congress are out of touch with the party base, and I absolutely believe that. 59% now believe that members of Congress are overpaid. That's up 10 percentage points from last October. Just 5% think that their Congress member is paid too little. 30% think the pay is about right. One reason for this attitude may be that most voters say they are or understand the health care legislation is better than Congress. Just 22% think the legislature has a good understanding of the issue. 3 out of 4, 74%, trust their own economic judgment more than the Congress. Just 14% give Congress good or excellent review for their overall performance, while only 16% believe it's very likely that Congress will address the most important problems facing our nation. 75% say members of Congress are more interested in their own careers than they are in helping people. On the brighter side, 37% say most in Congress have extramarital affairs. 59% of Americans believe that when members of Congress meet with regulators and other government officials, they do so to help their friends and hurt their political opponents. Most believe that's why politicians are able to solicit contributions from business leaders. Most, however, say it's generally a good investment because political donors get more than their money's worth. 57% of American adults say political donors get more than their money back in terms of favors from members of Congress. Despite these reviews, more than 90% of Congress routinely gets reelected every 2 years. It's a shock when any incumbent loses. One explanation for this phenomenon, frequently heard in Washington, D.C., is that people hate Congress but love their own congressmen. Voters have a different perspective, and 50% say rigged election rules explain high re-election rates for Congress. When the Constitution was written, the nation's founders expected that there would be 50% turnover in the House of Representatives every election cycle. That was the experience they witnessed in state legislatures at the time, and most of the state legislatures offered just one-year terms. For well over 100 years after the Constitution was adopted, the turnover rate averaged in the 50% range as expected. In the 20th century, turnover began to decline as power and prestige flowed to Washington during the New Deal era. Fewer and fewer members of Congress wanted to leave. In 1968, congressional turnover fell to single digits for the first time ever, and it has remained very low ever since. And so we need to reverse that. We need to make that not a very good, you know, not a job that people want to keep, you know, make a career out of. I want to make it more, you know, where people kind of feel like it's their civic duty. So let's see what else there is. Police health care reform used as New York crime ploy. Police say attackers used health care reform as a ruse to approach their victims and then shot two and pistol-whipped another in a Long Island home. Suffolk County police said Saturday that a 26-year-old woman was arrested on attempted murder and burglary charges. In the attack Friday in Huntington, two men were arrested in the same charges earlier. Information on the suspect's arraignments wasn't immediately available Saturday night. Police say three told the home's residents that they were selling insurance, referring to President Barack Obama's push to overhaul America's health care system. Police say the suspects then forced their way in, demanded money, and attacked the victims. Stimulus checks lure Floridians to their arrest. Miami. Police in a Florida city used the promise of economic stimulus checks to lure 76 people to their arrest on a variety of outstanding warrants. The Fort Lauderdale Police Department set up Operation Show Me the Money to round up people wanted on charges ranging from second-degree murder to guns and drug charges to fail to pay child support. Using the name of fictitious South Florida Stimulus Coalition, police mailed letters asking the suspects to call an undercover phone line and make appointments to claim their money. When they showed up at an auditorium and presented their identification, they were led to an area where uniformed police were waiting to arrest them. Police said such roundups are safer and more efficient than serving warrants at people's homes. You totally control the environment, whereas when you're walking up to someone's home, there's an unknown factor there, Police Sergeant Frank Sousa said on Friday. The operation ended on Thursday night, and Sousa declined to say how much money the suspects were offered. They were not large dollar amounts, he said. No one was promised thousands of dollars. That's actually pretty clever. And the reason it works is because these people, you know, you can't cheat an honest person. And if somebody thinks they're going to get something for nothing, especially a crook, you know, they've got that, you know, there are people that think they're going to get something for nothing. You know, our egos are always, you know, the wrong side of our ego, the egos, end up being, you know, something for nothing kind of appeals to that. Like, you know, you're something, your ego's something special. And so, you know, so it's not surprising that criminals in particular would, really be attracted to that, and that's a case of conning the con. That's pretty funny. Capitalism the villain as more movie hits Venice. London, the Venice Film Festival has capitalism in its sight this year, with premieres of Michael Moore's documentary on the U.S. economic meltdown and a drama starring Matt Damon as a corrupt corporate whistleblower. Capitalism, a Love Story, in competition at the annual Cinema Showcase, sees Moore take on the corporate bosses with his trademark combative style, bringing the hot topic of recession to the picturesque Lido waterfront. And The Informati, directed by Steven Soderbergh, and featuring Damon as a real-life crook executive who exposed his company's price-fixing tactics, will be screened out of competition. The festivals run from September 2nd to the 12th. Damon is one of several Hollywood A-listers due to grace the red carpet in 2009, as studios appear to be prepared to foot the substantial bill and come to Venice in order to generate buzz for their pictures as the award season kicks off. Hundreds of fans Waiting outside the main cinema, where gala premieres are held each day, we'll be hoping to catch a glimpse of Nicolas Cage, George Clooney, Oliver Stone, Charlie Theron, Eva Mendes, Richard Gere, and Sylvester Stallone, among others. The 2009 edition of the world's oldest film festival looks to eclipse 2008, which, despite awarding Mickey Rourke's acclaimed comeback, The Wrestler, with the Golden Lion for Best Film, was seen as a lackluster and lacking star power. So this kind of goes on. It doesn't really talk much about Michael Moore's movie. E-books could spell the end for hardbacks, warns Hatchet Chief. Hardback books could be killed off if Amazon's e-books and Google's digital library force publishers to slash prices. Arnaud Nouri, chief executive of French publishing group Hachette, has warned. Mr. Nouri said unilateral pricing by Google, Amazon, and other e-book retailers such as Barnes & Noble could destroy publishers' profits. He said publishers were very hostile to Amazon's pricing strategy, over which the online retailer failed to consult publishers to charge $9.99 for all its e-books in the U.S. He also pointed to plans by Google to put millions of out-of-copyright books online for public use. So, that's interesting. I don't know what to believe about that. That's, who knows. But, you know, if people, I mean, e-books have been around for a while, you know, and I'm not really attracted to them. I'm not going to buy a $300, whatever, however, how much it costs Amazon Kindle, forget it. You know, if I want a book, I'll just buy it. You know, I buy it on the spot. I want something that I can carry around with me. I don't have to put batteries in it. Don't have to worry about it running down. Don't have to worry about dropping it, breaking it, whatever. You know, I just don't, you know, the e-book thing does not appeal to me. I've got this email here that Ian sent me. Of course, Ian is from Ottawa, Canada. This is it's an article. Now, Ian is saying it will probably not pass. I think you already have it in Oregon and Washington State. And what this is, I'll read the article that he's forwarded. Dr. Jeff Blackmer knows the thin line that exists between helping someone die in comfort and purposely ending their life through medical euthanasia. The Ottawa physician, who also runs the Canadian Medical Association's Office of Ethics, deals mainly with spinal cord injuries, and a number of his patients are quadriplegics who depend on a respirator to stay alive. Some of those have asked to have their ventilators removed and be allowed to die. Dr. Blackmer, though an opponent of euthanasia, will prescribe drugs that allows the patients to pass without suffering. So what's the difference between letting someone die and giving them drugs to make it easier and giving them drugs that will kill them? He asked. Some may argue it's splitting hairs, but for physicians it's a critical difference in that the former case is the underlying disease that is causing death. We're letting nature run its course. The second situation of giving lethal drugs is more active, and it's opposed to what doctors are supposed to stand for. Such arguments will be aired again this fall when Bill C-384, which would make euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide legal, will come up for a second reading, the furthest such a bill has ever gone in Canada. It's the third time in 4 years that the Bloc MP Francine Ledonde has sponsored such a bill. And then he says it will probably not pass, and they already do have something like that in Oregon and in Washington State. So, you know, if someone, I don't know, we make heroic, so-called heroic efforts to save somebody's life, you know, somebody that's, you know, like they're quadriplegic and they put them on a ventilator, you know, and it's, you know, the machine's breathing for them, because if, you know, if they wouldn't have put them on there in the first place, then they would have been dead, you know, they wouldn't have saved their life. And, you know, that's, you know, that really puts doctors in a bad position, you know, because they take an oath, the Hippocratic Oath, to, you know, do no harm, but to do as, you know, to try to save as much life as they possibly can. And, you know, I would say probably the majority of people want to have their life saved. But, you know, then they, you know, then you have someone in a really difficult position like that, where they're on a ventilator, they're quadriplegic, they can't move. And, you know, that would be a difficult position to be in. And, but, you know, if they're directing, if the person in that case, if they can reliably tell somebody, I want you to pull the plug, I want you to take the ventilator out or shut it off, you know, is that, and the doctor complies, is the doctor guilty of murder? Or is that physician-assisted suicide? You know, or, you know, so that's kind of an iffy thing there. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, giving them drugs, like the guy was saying, that's more active. But, you know, people make these sorts of decisions anyway. But, you know, making it legal, you know, this is just a first step, you know, because the people that advocate this also, you know, it's like that, you know, that little spoof thing that I made up about the Planned Parenthood death centers. You know, where this goes, you know, ultimately there would be people that would want to just make it legal so that they could go to the doctor and just tell the doctor, doctor, I want you to kill me. I'm tired of living. Kill me. You know, I don't have the guts to kill myself. I want you to do it for me. And, you know, so I, you know, why corrupt the medical system with this? You know, because they're, I know it's kind of a difficult position, but, you know, then again, why should we be corrupting the laws with these sorts of things? With these sorts of laws, why should we corrupt it? You know, so now in this case, I guess it, you know, it's the whole thing, you know, the whole nation of Canada, as opposed to provinces, you know, where, as here in the United States, we got it in Oregon and Washington. And by the way, Washington, I don't know if you realize that, but Seattle is like the suicide capital. You know, it's long been known to be the suicide capital. There's more, you know, there's statistically, Seattle has a high suicide rate for some reason. And, you know, I think that kind of figures into this somehow. But, I don't know. You know, if states want to do it, I would think that, you know, they can. But, you know, in this case, you know, well, even if provinces wanted to do it, you know, that would be, you know, but that would be a better than trying to force it on the whole nation of, you know, the whole nation at once. So, I don't know. It's kind of a sticky wicket, but people are making these decisions every day. You know, and there aren't that many people that are put into these positions, but there are people that make these decisions every day. And, you know, if the doctor, you know, I'd say that probably already the doctors, if some patients are telling the doctor, I want to die, then the doctor just kind of quietly pulls the plug or discontinues the treatment. If the patient, well, let me put it this way. Let's say that the patient is a quadriplegic, they're on a ventilator, and the patient tells the doctor, I want you to discontinue my treatment. Now, and then if the doctor complies and discontinues the treatment, meaning the ventilator, Now, is that killing the patient? Did the doctor commit murder? I don't think so. He's just responding to the... So if they, you know, if anything, they should just say, well, the patient has a right to, you know, in order to protect the doctor, the patient has a right to direct the doctor to withdraw treatment, you know, which I would think that the patient already has that right. So, but I don't see that it really needs a special law to kind of legalize it specifically, and especially with the active drugs. You know, that's really over the top. But the goal of people that push these sorts of laws, I believe, ultimately is to just normalize suicide, make it legal and normal, and kind of up its, you know, make it a respectable thing to do. And of course it's not. So anyway, probably better be cutting this off and see if I can get it uploaded and get headed to bed here in a bit. So I hope everyone had a great weekend. Hope you have a great week coming up, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.